Charles Wright's poetry has been called many things: painterly, philosophical, theological, landscape-oriented, southern. These labels are true, as his poetry is saturated with images, with that activity called thinking, with spiritual searching, and with the landscapes of the Blue Ridge, California, Montana, Italy. But they're ultimately inadequate because they fail to convey the power of his work and risk diminishing its reach and depth. What Wright has achieved in his poetry for the past three decades is a masterful synthesis of imagery, thought, and geography, yes, but also of American, Italian, and Chinese culture, literature, and history, to name just a few of the recurring elements of Wright's poems. To pin down Wright's poetry becomes an impossible task because the work is so large. The poems even look big, sprawling across the page as if it were a canvas, lines breaking and stepping down to ride hard at the right margin, poems titles becoming longer than your average poetic line, poems building into sequences, into books, into trilogies. And despite their Whitman-esque proportions, the poems very often carry the kind of compression we find in Emily Dickinson's poetry, producing what Wright has called the odd marriage of Emily and Walt. And Wright's poems are literally odd. If you count the syllables in each line, you'll see what I mean. Preoccupied with circularity and symmetry, Wright is something of a mathematical mystic. He once wrote that my poetic structures tend toward the conditions of spiderwebs, tight in their parts but loose in the holes, and endlessly repetitious. Despite their intricate structures and metaphysical concerns, the poems are conversational, intimate, accessible, or, as he once coined, meta-quotidian. Wright's ability to keep working in the style he perfected in the late 1970s, to continuously reinvigorate that style while dwelling on similar concerns and landscapes, recalls the works of painters like Cézanne and Morandi, two of his heroes. Like the painters, Wright knows that to look hard at something, to look through it, is to transform it, convert it into something beyond itself. Or, with some Heraclitus thrown in, you can't see the same thing twice. In Wright's poem Black Zodiac, he says, "The unexamined life's no different from the examined life. Unanswerable questions, small talk, unprovable theorems, long-abandoned arguments, you've got to write it all down. Landscape or waterscape, light length on evergreen, dark sidebar of evening, you've got to write it down." Fortunately for us, Wright has followed his own advice, producing one of the most vital bodies of work of our time. The bulk of Wright's work can be found in three volumes: Country Music, The World of the 10,000 Things, and Negative Blue, each of which gathers work from three other books. Wright calls this trilogy of trilogies the Appalachian Book of the Dead, which he finished as the 20th century was drawing to a close, and parts of which have received almost every poetry award in existence: the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the Ruth Lilly Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and so on. So far in the 21st century, he has published the books A Short History of the Shadow, Buffalo Yoga, Scar Tissue, and most recently, Littlefoot. He comes to Richmond this evening from Charlottesville, where he is the Souter Family Professor of English at the University of Virginia. So help me welcome Charles Wright.
This poem is called In Praise of Thomas Hardy. Each second, the earth is struck hard by 4.5 pounds of sunlight. Each second. Try to imagine that. No wonder deep shade is what the soul longs for, and not, as we always thought, the light. No wonder the inner life is dark. Sounding and sicked on like a dog, they all go down and devolve, vowel dancing, heart sick, hoping for realignment and a space that won't shine. Unlike the October moon, apached and blade-dazzled, small down the western sky into Ovidian intersect with time in its ghostly renderings. Unlike the leaves of the ash tree, moon-treated and hanging on for one day longer or so. Unlike our shrunk selves, dripping like washing on the line. The poem is called In Praise of Thomas Hardy because he said, "I refuse to stop using the word small as a verb." So if you didn't catch it, I used it as a verb. I hope. Otherwise, it has nothing to do with Thomas Hardy. Actually, most of my titles had nothing to do with the poems that followed them. You know you're in trouble when your titles get more interesting than your poems. I reached that point about 25 years ago. So every once in a while, I try to go back to a normal title, like this one called River Run. In spite of armchair and omelet, in spite of the daily paradise and quid pro quo, like Lorca, I wait for the things of the other side. A little river of come and go, a heartbeat of sorts, a watch tick, a splash in the night. Wherever I turn, everything looks unworldly already. The stars in their empty boxes, the lights of the high houses glowing like stones through the thrones of the trees, the river hushed in a brown study. What isn't available is always what's longed for. It's written, erased, then written again. Thus lost and unknown, thus master of the undeciphered parchment, thus hail and farewell. It's not the bullet that kills you, as the song goes, it's the hole. It's not the water you've got to cross, it's the river. Laurie Anderson wrote that song. Charles Wright stole the line. This poem is called Relics. It mentions an Italian writer named Aldo Buzzi, who wrote a fabulous book called Journey to the Land of the Flies about Sicily, and has written other things and was a screenwriter. And I think is still alive at about 98, living in Milano. After a time, Hoss, it makes such little difference what anyone writes. Relics, it seems, of the thing are always stronger than the thing itself. Palimpsest and Pentimento, for instance, saints' bones or saints' blood, transcendent architecture of what was possible, say, once upon a time. The dogwoods bloom, the pink ones and the white ones, in blots and splotches across the dusk, like clouds, perhaps. Mock clouds in a mock heaven, the faint odor of something unworldly or otherworldly lingering in the darkness, then not, as though some saint had passed by the side yard. The odor of paradise, as Aldo Buzzi has it. Odor of heaven, the faithful say. And what is this odor like? Someone who'd smelled it was asked once. He had no answer and said, it doesn't resemble any flower or any bloom or spice on this earth. I wouldn't know how to describe it. Lingering as the dark comes on. Saint Gaspare del Bufalo was one of these fragrant saints, Buzzi continues. Saint Gaspare, who walked in the rain without an umbrella and still stayed dry. Miraculous gift. He knew, he added, one of the saint's relatives, a pianist, who served him an osso buco once in a penthouse in Milan. Let's see. A cold spring in Charlottesville, end of April 2000. If you can't say what you got to say in three lines, better change your style. Nobody's born redeemed. Nobody's moonlight, golden fuse in the deadly trees. White wind through black wires, humming a speech we do not speak. Listen for us in the dark hours. Listen for us in our need. I think the idea of a guy being a saint because he's so skinny he can walk in the rain without getting wet is ridiculous. One person laughed once at that, and I had to stop the reading and get down and put my head on the floor and thank him. This is called The Gospel According to Saint Someone. Reflected radiance, moon envy, we hang outside ourselves like bats, clothed in our flash dreams. Sunset soaks down to the last leaves of the autumn trees. Under our heads, the world is a long drop in an ache. Above us, the sky forks. Great road to the left, great road to the right. Someone will come and walk on his hands through the dry grass to the altar. Someone will take the wafer. Someone will take the wine and walk back through the gravestones. Succor us, someone. Let us drink from your mouth. Let us eat from your tongue. Eternal penny, counterfeit truth, score us and pay us off. Buried November, read us our rights. Salvation, weary our sins. Awake, we all share the same world. Asleep, we're each in our own. Lay me down, Lord, let me sleep. This poem is called Arrivederci Kingsport. Kingsport is a little town in East Tennessee on the Holston River, where Daniel Boone set off to make the Wilderness Trail, and where yours truly and your new president, Edward Ayers, no matter what they say in his biography, grew up, and so did his wife. It's a great place to grow up in. It's a great place to leave from. Arrivederci, of course, means ciao, you know, goodbye. There's a list, of about, 10 names here, none of whom you know, but you know who they are because you have the same 10 in your own lives, wherever you are. As I say, it's in East Tennessee, about 5 miles from the Virginia line. It's all interstate anymore. The Sedgefields, Ted, Glenn, and I would shoot doves on or underwater. The country music highway out of the hollers and backwash of southeastern Kentucky, old U.S. 23, has carried the boys to a different demarcation, their voices like field mice in the 21st century wind. Goodbye to that stuff. The late 40s and early 50s and adolescence, Dolores Urquiza and Clara Hall, memories, music just out of tune, drifting in their seventh grade frocks across the civic auditorium floor. Goodbye to Sundays and band practice, the back seats of cars. Goodbye to WKPT and everybody's song. Jesus, it's still a fist of mist that keeps on cleaning my clock. Tick-tock, my youth. Tick-tock, my youth. Everything going away again and again toward the light. Who will remember Christina Marsh and Bobby Stepp now that I'm gone? Who will remember the frog famine now that the nameless roads have carried us all from town? Midsummer in 1951, the censor gone, the call and response both gone. How far away is all that? A life unremarkable, but one which was remarked, it turns out. Without consolation, it seemed, adolescence, the summer seeped to its end, the sweet smoke of the past like bandages on all our imagined wounds. And once upon a time in the long afternoons of autumn, the boys and girls would lay them down in the bitter weeds and watch the hidden meanderings of stars in their luminous disguise, that ill-invested blue. Is there a reprieve for this act? Is there a reprieve for such regard? Not in this life, and not in the next. Well, yes, but beside the point. And what's the point? The point is the drawn-out landfall from Chestnut Ridge to Moccasin Gap. The point is U.S. 11W disappearing in front of us and behind our backs, the winter winds and the clouds that dog our footsteps out west and back east. And so the dance continues. Boots Duke and Jackie Emery, Bevo and Kay Churchill, Jim Churchill and Nancy Sims, name after name dropping into the dark waters of day before yesterday, Champ Batchelder and Karen Bell, Bill Ring and Sarah Lou, slow dance, the music coming up again. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Da-da-da-da-da. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. The soft air Tennessee night gathers its children in its cupped hands. Time has its covenant, and who's to say that it is unjust? We make our sad arrangements. The sky clears, the sun sets. No matter the words, we never forget our own song. They used to end all dances with goodnight, sweetie. Back in the Pleistocene age, 1951, Jesus Christ, it's 1951? And I was 16 then. It just isn't fair. Well, this poem mentions Richmond, so I figured I better read it, because I have never read it before. I hope I don't stumble over. Call my own little Civil War. I come from the only county in Tennessee that did not secede throughout the entire Civil War. Sullivan County, rock-ribbed, recalcitrant Appalachian cornerstone. My kinfolk were otherwise, Arkansans and Mississippians, Virginians and Tar Heels. Still, I was born just a half mile from Shiloh Churchyard and had a relative, the family story goes, who served there, Confederate quartermaster, who took the occasion that first day to liberate many bills from Union coffers as the Johnnies swept through to the river and never replaced them when the bluebellies swept back and through the following afternoon. My great-grandfather Wright left VMI to join up with Lee in the Army of Northern Virginia somewhere near Richmond and ended up, lucky lad, a staff officer in the general's command. Who knows how many letters that took. After the war, he went back to Lexington with Lee, the general to Washington College in Immortality, Captain Wright at the far end of town still marching away the lost cause. Mars Robert has his horse and white tomb under the oak trees. My great-grandfather has his name in a long, thin line of others who were captains of the Corps of Cadets, two little boys, too late. My great-grandfather Penzel, 4 years in the country, saddled up in 1861 in Little Rock with the Capital City Guards and struck out for Tennessee. His name is last on the list, carved in print on an obelisk in front of a civic building somewhere near downtown. Just like everybody else, he finished the war as a captain. Enduring the raw campaigns of Southeast Tennessee, Chickamauga 2 years in Rock Island Prison, deep wounds in his mouth and elsewhere, then back like all the others into the thick of it. A long way for a country boy, slaveless and no stake in it, from the green hills of Bohemia. There are letters from Isaac Wright, Bladen County, North Carolina, 1856, to his son near Lafayette Courthouse, Red River, Arkansas, a dozen or so I cannot decipher, political and familial, about President Franklin Pierce wishing that John C. Calhoun were still alive and president instead, and the constitutional rights of the South established with greater force and greater clarity. I fear that we shall yet have difficulties with our northern brethren. And then the price of Negroes, nearby farms, the fear of high water, the price of cotton, always the price of cotton. Then love to Elizabeth, my son, and you and the children. All this from the documents left by my great aunt Marcella, a folder that also holds inexplicably my grandmother's marriage license and one short sketch so titled of the Fulton and Nowlin families. So much for all that. However, wrapped in wax paper among the letters is another small envelope containing a lock, so-called, of Robert E. Lee's hair, sent by him to the wife of the lucky lad from VMI. That's it, my own little Civil War, a lock of hair, a dozen unreadable letters, an obit or two, and half the weight and half life of a half-healed and hurting world. I got involved in something this summer where all the participants were given a leather-bound copy of their book. And this was in the summer when I was in Montana, and I couldn't leave it for for the mice to eat because it's got really good glue in it and stitching and stuff. And so I changed my other one for this one. The trouble is, you can't open the goddamn thing. You know, it's made out of leather. Back in the mid-1950s, when Time magazine was more important than it is now, they ran a cover story about the silent generation. Those of us who were born in the 30s, basically, I was born in 1935, and who came of age in the mid-50s and didn't seem to protest anything or didn't seem to do anything. The Eisenhower years, where everything was cool. Not quite. Anyhow, we were called the Silent Generation. And so I wrote three poems called the Silent Generation. This is the third one. I tried to get somebody to make an anthology called The Silent Generation Speaks, but he didn't do it. He collected over about 150 names of poets born in the 30s. Silent Generation 3. These are our voices. Active, passive, and suppressed. And these are our syllables. We use them to love your daughters. We use them to love your sons. We travel, we stayed home, we counted our days out like prescription pills. In the end, like everyone, we had too much to say. We live by the seat of our pants. We bet on the come, only to come up short. And see as the smoke began to clear, the life we once thought that boundless canopy of sky was just the sound of an axe echoing in the woods. We hadn't the heart for heartlessness. We hadn't the salt or the wound. The words welled, but goodness and mercy declined to follow us. We carried our wings on our own backs. We ate our dead. Like loose light bulbs, we kept our radiance to ourselves. Not heavy enough to be the hangman's burden, our noose names are scrawled in the dust discursively, line after line. Too strange for our contemporaries will prove to be not strange enough for posterity. O you who come after us, read our remains. Study the soundless bones and do otherwise. This is called Time Will Tell. Time was when time was not, and the world an uncut lawn ready for sizing. We looked and took the job in hand. Birds burst from our fingers, cities appeared, and small towns in the interim. We loved them all. In distant countries, tides nibbled our 2 feet on pebbly shores with their soft teeth and languorous tongues. Words formed and flew from our fingers. We listened and loved them all. Now finitude looms like antimatter, not this and not that, and everywhere, like a presence one bumps into, oblivious, unwittingly. Excuse me, I beg your pardon, but time has no pardon to beg and no excuses. The wind in the meadow grasses, the wind through the rocks bends and breaks whatever it touches. It's never the same wind in the same spot, but it's still the wind and blows in its one direction, northwest to southeast, an ointment upon the skin, a little saliva. Time with its murderous gums and pale, windowless throat, its mouth pressed to our mouths, pushing the breath in, pulling it out. You all are much too young to be listening to these poems, but I hope someday you have the occasion to think back and say, I remember when that old fool warned me about what was going to happen, and I didn't pay any attention to him whatsoever. As well you should not. This is called The Woodpecker Pecks, but the hole does not appear. That's the funny part of my reading. It has nothing to do with the poem. It's hard to imagine how unremembered we all become. How quickly all that we've done is unremembered and unforgiven. How quickly bog lilies and yellow clover flashlight our footfalls. How quickly And finally, the landscape subsumes us and everything that we are becomes what we're not. This is not new. The orange finch and the yellow and dun finch picking the dry clay politely. The grass is asleep in their green slips before the noon can rouse them. The sweet oblivion of the everyday like a warm waistcoat over the cold and endless body of memory. Cloud scarce Montana morning. July with its blue cheeks puffed out like a puto on an ancient map. Huffing the wind down from the northwest corner of things. Tweets on the evergreen stumps, swallows treading the air, the ravens hawking from tree to tree, not you, not you, is all that the world allows and all one could wish for. This book is a book-length poem, and I'm going to try to read one section. I'm not going to try, I'm going to do it, but I don't know that it'll make any sense, but then none of those make any sense either, so what the hell. Midnight and 5 minutes to midnight were famous show horses when I was growing up, late 40s, early 50s, and they went from town to town throughout the South doing whatever show horses did, single foot Tennessee walking business. They were very famous horses. This is set in the mountains of Montana. Well, part of it is and part of it isn't, but the first part is. The great mouth of the West hangs open. Mountain incisors beginning to bite into the pink flesh of the sundown. The end of another day in this floating dream of a life. Renown is a mouthful here and there. Rivers and mountains glide through my blood. Cold pillow, bittersweet years. In the near distance, a plane's drone rattles the windows. Clear night. Wind like a predator in the sharp grass of the past. I find it much simpler now to see the other side of my own death. It wasn't always that way, when the rivers were rivers and mountains were mountains. Now, when the mouth closes, the wind goes out of everything. Fame for 100 years is merely an afterlife, and no friend of ours. Better to watch the rain fall on the branches of winter trees. Better to have your mail sent to someone else in another town where frost is whiter than moonlight. Horses, black horses, midnight, 5 minutes to midnight. Rider up, the sparks from their hooves like stars, like spiked stars. This is a metaphor for failure. This is the rest of it. The beautiful horse, black horse, midnight, dark horse, dark rider. I love the lethargy of the single cloud, the stillness of the sky on winter afternoons, late on winter afternoons, a little fan of light on the tips of the white pines. I love the winter light, so thin, so unbuttery, transparent as plastic wrap, clinging so effortlessly to whatever it skins over. The language of nature, we know, is mathematics. The language of landscape is language. Metaphor, 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 all down the line. The sweet breath baby light of a winter afternoon, boy light, half covered in blue, almost invisible as breath, so still in the flower beds, so pale. 4 days till the full moon, light like a new skin on the dark quarter, like light unborrowed, hard, black hole with its golden floor. Who knows the happiness of fish, their wind-raising, ordinary subtleties? Describing the indescribable, image into idea, the transmission of the spirit, it cannot be done. The Chinese principle, breath, resonance, life, motion, engenders, it was believed. As does the bone method of brushwork, creating structure in poems as well as pictures. plotting in paint, place in poetry completes composition, the bedrock of spiritual values. Competent, marvelous, and divine were the three degrees of accomplishment, and still it cannot be done. Image resists all transmutation. All art is meta art and has its own satisfaction, but it's not divine as image is, untouchable, untransmutable, holy magic. Midnight special, turn your ever loving light on me. I want to read a couple of short ones. I'll read six of them because they're six lines each. I wrote a whole sack full of them. But the form is self-defeating ultimately, because you say this and you encounter with this, or you say this and you say something you think is important, or you say this and you can't get out of it because you only got six lines. There's nowhere to go. But I've cut them back down. Some of them have good titles like this one. Time is a dark clock, but it still strikes from time to time. Whumpty ump, pump, pump, tweedly, tweedly, tweedly dee. I'm as happy as can be. Pretty nice. But that was then, when our hearts were meat on the grill. And who was it? Etta James or Ruth Brown or Laverne Baker? The past is so dark you need a flashlight to find your own shoes. But what shoes? And always a half inch off the floor. Your feet like wind inside them. No more singing now, I promise. I cannot carry a tune. This is called Walking Beside the Diversion Ditch Lake. I love to make the kingfishers fly from their bony perches above the lake, six or seven, one after the next, circling the water and chattering back as I walk along. Can the fish hear them? Is their cry like organ cording leading to one vast ultimate stomp? Who was it who first said, the kingfisher falls through fire? The ghost of Walter Benjamin walks at night. Or, the ghost of Walter Benjamin walks at midnight. The world's an untranslatable language without words or parts of speech. It's a language of objects our tongues can't master, but which we are the ardent subjects of. If tree is tree in English and albero in Italian, that's as close as we can come to divinity, the language that circles the earth in which we'll never speak. Bees are the terrace builders of the stars. It's odd how the objects of our lives continue to not define us, no matter how close we hold them unto us. Odd how the narrative of those lives is someone else's narrative. Now the increasing sundown, the Bible draws the darkness around it, no footbridge or boat over Lethe, no staircase or stepping stone up into the into. When the horses gallop away from us, it's a good thing. I always find it strange, though I shouldn't, how creatures don't care for us the way we care for them. Horses, for instance, and chipmunks, and any bird you'd name. Empathy's only a one-way street. And that's all right, I've come to believe. It sets us up for ultimate things, and penultimate ones as well. It's a great lesson to have in your pocket when the call comes to call. And one last one called No Angel. In the kingdom of the hollow at heart, the insect is king. In the kingdom of the beyond, all lie where the ground is smooth. Everything's what it seems to be, and a little less. In the land of the unutterable, words float like reflections across the water. Nobody visits us up here. Like shadows, we spread ourselves until our hands touch, then disappear in the dark.